Robin is going to lead us a little later on in the final look at the book of Nehemiah. We've been working through Nehemiah now for a number of weeks, and we've come to chapter 13. So if you have a Bible and you want to turn with me, if not, it will appear up on the screen. We're going to read Nehemiah chapter 13. You remember that the people have been assembled together, and beginning of this might seem a little unusual, but bear in mind these people had not been familiar with the Word of God for a long time. This is not the only occasion in Israel's history when they rediscover the Word of God as if it was the first time they'd ever come across it. And that's the background to this passage. On that day, the book of Moses was read aloud in the hearing of the people, and there it was found written that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever be admitted into the assembly of God, because they had not met the Israelites with food and water, but had hired Balaam to call a curse down on them. Our God, however, turned the curse into a blessing. When the people heard this law, they excluded from Israel all who were of foreign descent. Before this, Eliashib the priest had been put in charge of the storerooms of the house of our God. He was closely associated with Tobiah, and he had provided him with a large room formerly used to store the grain offerings and incense and temple articles, and also the tithes of grain, new wine, and olive oil, prescribed for the Levites, musicians, and gatekeepers, as well as the contributions for the priests. But while all this was going on, I was not in Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I'd returned to the king. Sometime later, I asked his permission to come back to Jerusalem. Here I learned about the evil thing Eliashib had done in providing Tobiah a room in the courts of the house of God. I was greatly displeased, and threw all Tobiah's goods out of the room. I gave orders to purify the rooms, and then I put back into them the equipment of the house of God with the grain offerings and the incense. I also learned that portions assigned to the Levites had not been given to them, and that all the Levites and musicians responsible for the service had gone back to their own fields. So I rebuked the officials and asked them, "Why is the house of God neglected?" Then I called them together and stationed them at their posts. All Judah brought the tithes of grain, new wine, and olive oil into the storerooms. I put Shemaiah the priest, Zadok the scribe, and a Levite named Pedaiah in charge of the storerooms, and made Hanan the son of Zakur, the son of Mattaniah, their assistant, because they were considered trustworthy. They were made responsible for distributing the supplies to their fellow Levites. Remember me for this, my God, and do not blot out what I have so faithfully done for the house of my God and its services. In those days, I saw people in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in grain and loading it on donkeys, together with wine, grapes, figs, and all other kinds of loads. And they were bringing all this into Jerusalem on the Sabbath. Therefore, I warned them against selling food on that day. People from Tyre who lived in Jerusalem were bringing in fish and all kinds of merchandise and selling them in Jerusalem on the Sabbath to the people of Judah. I rebuked the nobles of Judah and said to them, "What is this wicked thing you're doing, desecrating the Sabbath day? Didn't your ancestors do the same things so that our God brought all this calamity on us and on this city? Now you are stirring up more wrath against Israel by desecrating the Sabbath." When evening shadows fell on the gates of Jerusalem before the Sabbath, I ordered the doors to be shut and not opened until the Sabbath was over. I stationed some of my own men at the gates so that no load could be brought in on the Sabbath day. Once or twice, the merchants and sellers of all kinds of goods spent the night outside Jerusalem. But I warned them and said, "Why do you spend the night by the wall? If you do this again, I'll arrest you." From that time on, they no longer came on the Sabbath. Then I commanded the Levites to purify themselves, and go and guard the gates in order to keep the Sabbath day holy. Remember me for this also, my God, and show mercy to me according to your great love. Moreover, in those days I saw men of Judah who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. Half their children spoke the language of Ashdod or the language of one of the other peoples and did not know how to speak the language of Judah. I rebuked them and called curses down on them. I beat some of the men and pulled out their hair. I made them take an oath in God's name and said, "You are not to give your daughters in marriage to their sons, nor are you to take their daughters in marriage for your sons or for yourselves." Was it not because of marriages like these that Solomon, the king of Israel, sinned? Among the many nations, there was no king like him. He was loved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. But even he was led into sin by foreign women. Must we hear now that you too are doing all this terrible wickedness and are being unfaithful to our God by marrying foreign women? One of the sons of Jehoiada, son of Eliashib, the high priest, was son-in-law to Sanballat, the Horonite, and I drove him away from me. Remember them, my God, because they defiled the priestly office and the covenant of the priesthood and of Levites. So I purified the priests and the Levites of everything foreign and assigned them duties, each to his own task. I also made provision for contributions of wood at designated times and for the first fruits. Remember me with favor, my God. Pray God will open up his word and just bless Robin as he brings God's word to us from that passage.
Now, I thought it might just help if we just spent literally a few seconds going through it. Now, Colin, are you impressed or not that I've managed to find the same picture you were using? Yeah. It was almost the first one on Google Images. Great. We've been through it over about 10 weeks or so. And we started off looking at Nehemiah's passion and prayer. There's a lot in that first passage that tells us about him as a man, as a godly man. And then described to us next was the state of Jerusalem, the state it had got into, a pitiful state, and then a great description with lots of names on how the work began on repairing it. And then, as with all works of God, it doesn't go for long before there's serious opposition, and we looked at that in chapter 4. And then in chapter 5, almost the diversion to see how Nehemiah straightened people up over the business of justice amongst the people, the poor being properly cared for and loved and looked after. And then more opposition back in the firing line. Some of these were given another title on the day. I can't remember them all. And then we had this one where Ezra reads the law. I think that was called The Perfect Sunday by Steve Morris, if I recall, as people met and heard the word of God explained and preached indeed, and certainly read. And then confession and covenant as the people before God assembled and confessed and recommitted themselves to the covenant, to their agreement with God and he with them. And nothing happened when I clicked it next. There were more after that. Oh, there we go. And they all come at once. That's always the way. So the dedication of the wall, we actually missed one out in favor of the Sweet Pea weekend, I think. And then we had the dedication of the wall last week with Colin. And then this one, only highlighted because it's the current one, not because it's the most important, the unfinished work. So the events of the book of Nehemiah span about 13 years. Coincidentally, there are 13 chapters. And we could say that the two main actions of the book are the rebuilding of the wall, which is fairly obvious, but also the recommitment of the returned exiles, the people of Judah, to fulfill their covenant obligations. So throughout all of this, Nehemiah himself emerges as a godly, passionate, decisive leader, dealing wisely but firmly with opposition. So just for about 3 minutes, a quick recap then of where all this fits in. So after the exile, God is effectively renewing his people in the land in order to carry out what he promised to Abram. We've heard about him already tonight. And Genesis 12:2, we read the words, God speaking to Abraham, I will make you into a great nation and I will bless you. And then later on in chapter 17 of Genesis, verse 3, God said to Abraham, as for me, this is my covenant with you. You'll be a father of many nations. Then later, I will make you very fruitful. The whole land of Canaan, where you now reside as a foreigner, I will give as an everlasting possession to you and your descendants after you, and I will be their God. So this whole book has been part of that fulfillment. That's where it fits into God's plan for his people. Meanwhile, the people themselves, on their part, must renew their commitment to covenant faithfulness. In other words, by laying hold of God's forgiveness and by seeking to practice purity in their lives together and their private individual lives. So God, in his mercy, raises up firstly Ezra, the priest and teacher, and then Nehemiah, the governor, in these two books that we read about them, which is effectively two volumes of the same book. They're joint books, really, to lead his people in the hard work that renewal requires. And I think that should have been obvious to us by now, but it will continue to be obvious, I think, as we look at this passage. And that the public ceremonies that we've seen of in chapters 8 to 10, they in a way enact this renewal of by confessing past unfaithfulness and recognizing, importantly recognizing, that everything, including Israel's mission to bring light to the world, depends on God's grace and his steadfast commitment to his promises. We read in chapter 9, verse 32, now therefore our God, the great God, mighty and awesome, who keeps his covenant of love. And then later, you have remained righteous, you have acted faithfully while we acted wickedly. And later, verse 38, in view of all this, we are making a binding agreement, putting it in writing, and our leaders, our Levites and our priests are affixing their seals to it. So this was their statement. We need to keep this in mind when we consider what we're looking at tonight. Now, just by way of an illustration, we had an extension put on the back of our bungalow in the last few years. And it left the garden looking like a building site. In fact, the garden was a building site. And it took us a good couple of years to get it something like. Now, wouldn't it have been nice to think that that was it? That was the job done? That we could sit back and enjoy our lawns, which the estate agents call them pleasure lawns. I think it's a ridiculous overstatement. And our flower borders. Wouldn't that be lovely to be able to just do that? For years to come, forever and ever. But of course, the reality you all know is absolutely nothing like that. There are things called weeds and aphids and slugs. And we have a particularly friendly bunch of caterpillars that seem to want to eat everything. And these all have an input, don't they, into this garden that we thought we'd got sort of finished. Or just consider you go away for 1 week's holiday. I speak about this because we've just done that. And you come back and there are weeds and there's deadheading to be done and everything's overgrown. Whatever a garden is, it is never a finished work. Now, we'll find that the whole life of the church and the life of the Christian, this side of glory, is equally never a finished work. So in this passage here, we find the wall has been finished. The physical restoration of Jerusalem in that sense is complete, although no doubt it will need maintaining, but that's not the point of this passage. The spiritual restoration of the people is clearly an ongoing business. And after all their confessions and affirmations recorded in chapters 9 and 10, Nehemiah could be forgiven for thinking, like me with my garden, that he'd earned a rest. He could sit back, he'd got everything in order, God's people knew how to live, and they'd said that they would keep to it. So that sounded promising. But no, Nehemiah comes back from some time away, And already there is so much that needs doing. Not to the wall, that we're told of anyway, but definitely with the people. Now, it's worth noting that he'd been back to Susa, reading verse 6, which was the capital of the Persian Empire. It's where he came from, if you like, having served the king there as cupbearer. And it's about 1,000 miles from Jerusalem. So we're talking probably 4 months there and back, added to which however long he spent there, which might have been months and months. So it's an extended absence. Certainly time for things to have slipped. And we'll start to look now at how they had slipped. This is the way we are going to proceed. Those are the headings that we're going to divide this passage under, but we'll take them one at a time, if it will talk to me. So let's start with verses 4-9 then. There we go. Before this, Elisha the priest had been put in charge of the storerooms of the house of our God. He was closely associated with Tobiah. Some sort of warning music at this point should be played. And he had provided him with a large room formerly used to store the grain offerings and incense and temple articles, and also the tithes of grain, new wine and olive oil prescribed for the Levites, musicians and gatekeepers, as well as the contributions for the priests. So that word before this, basically before verses 1 and 3 and what we read in there, this explains that the ruling regarding the admittance of foreigners to the assembly of God. In other words, this is the rest of the chapter after verse 3 is like a giant flashback explaining how those first three verses came to be. Nehemiah had been away, as we've said, and when the cat's away, you can finish that one off. Nehemiah is clearly a man of some determination. It's a little bit worrying to discover that his opponents are as well. They're not easily put off. So we come across Tobiah. He should sound familiar to us, albeit with a sense of foreboding. It was he who, back in chapter 2, verse 19, and chapter 4, verse 3, mocked this work for the Lord. He seemed to think that was his function in life, was to mock the Lord's work. And then in verse 1 of chapter 6, straightforwardly, is classed as an enemy of God's people. What kind of a person is he? He's divisive. He's a slippery individual. We find that he's in touch with a lot of people. I mean, if emails and Facebook had been around in those days, he'd have been on that all the time. He's connected, and this is really significant, we'll see later, he's connected by marriage to a lot of people among God's people, prominent people. His wife and his son's wife are both daughters of prominent people, probably priests among the people of God. He seems to have an air of what we might call up to no good about him. I have the feeling that if you met him and you simply stared at him, he'd say, "What?" You know, the kind of person, we've all met them. There's just a feeling of up to no good. And some commentators summed him up as an open and contemptuous enemy of God. Now, in connection to the first three verses of the chapter, the connection lies in the fact that Tobiah was an Ammonite. He was an Ammonite. On that day, the book of Moses read aloud in the hearing of people, and there it is found written that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever be admitted into the assembly of God. And here he is, not just admitted, but literally living. He's moved in to the temple. He's been given, if you like, an apartment in there. So Eliashib, who is the high priest at the time, in Nehemiah's absence, his offence is also related, and we'll see this later, to the theme of proper administration of tithes and offerings for the priests and Levites, you might say, the ministers of the day. And it's related to that because, as we've said, Tobiah has been given a room actually in the temple reserved for these things. So Eliashib really gets it wrong twice. One, by letting Tobiah in, and two, by throwing the tithes and offerings out. And then from verse 6, we can see that Eliashib must have been opposed to Nehemiah's policy of strict separation from Judah's neighbours. He's clearly taken advantage of Nehemiah's rather lengthy absence. And we read that not only does Nehemiah throw Tobiah out, the feeling he probably enjoyed that, but that he had those rooms cleansed in some sort of ritual sense. I don't know how that worked. I can almost smell the J's fluid. Nehemiah sees it as a misuse of the temple. He sees it as a real desecration. And he wants to restore those polluted areas to their proper use. So we can see some applications straight away, can't we? Because as believers, we are we're often told, aren't we, we're in the world, but we're not of the world. Like a boat is in the water, but when it becomes of it, it sinks. Now, obviously, we need to have to do with unbelievers. Otherwise, how can we possibly show them the gospel? And it's wonderful to have people who are seeking God, who are not yet believers, in our service with us, and that's always a good thing. But it's a very different thing to invite them in this sense. In what sense? Well, when we start to, for example, compromise God's law or compromise the gospel in order to please those who are, in fact, the enemies of God, who have nothing to do with Christ at all, then we're doing the equivalent of what Eliashib did with Tobiah. So here, an enemy of God and an enemy of his people has been allowed to worm his way into the very temple. Now, as we said, Nehemiah gave him, as we might say, short shrift. But we need to be just as ruthless, don't we, when worldly philosophies or values worm their way into the church or into our lives or into our thinking. Now, you probably all know this word, but I've discovered the word milieu in the last couple of years. It seemed, and then once you've heard it, you keep hearing it. Sorry, my home group's heard this very recently. Comes from two French words meaning mid and place. So basically, it means the sort of place where you're in the middle of. And a simple definition is people, physical and social conditions and events that provide the environment in which someone acts or lives. So it's the kind of, it's where you are socially, it's where you are, it's almost the atmosphere of the world in which you live, of the society, of your country, of your environment. And of course, that is going to affect the way you think. And we need to be very, very careful as God's people who claim to stick with his word, that we don't let those things seep into us. It's been true all the way through history. It was very much true in Nehemiah's day, and it's abundantly true today. And Eliashib might have appeared to be a peace-loving reconciler who's invited this man in. You know, let's try to patch up a bit. But he's got this quite wrong. And we need to be aware that we have an enemy of our souls who will happily move in to one of our the storerooms of our temple, if you like, our own lives. So the second thing is the next few verses from verse 10, dealing with neglect of offerings. I also learned that portions assigned to Levites had not been given to them, and that all the Levites and musicians responsible for the service had gone back to their own fields. So I rebuked the officials and asked them why is the house of God neglected? And so he goes on. Now, clearly, there is, in this section, some connection with the installation of Tobiah, because he kind of displaced these things. And we can see a chain reaction. If you want to put it in these terms, that the provision for the clergy had effectively lapsed. Notice that the complaint is not that there was no collection from the people. It was just that it didn't get to the right people. Where it went, we're not told. Tobiah might be looking guilty at this moment. We don't, but we're just not told. We don't want to be unfair to him. But as a result, worship itself suffered. And because the clergy had to leave Jerusalem, to work in their own fields, which would be disastrous for a spiritual community. Imagine a church, to bring it nearer to home, that simply stopped its offerings. The pastor then takes up secular work to support himself and his family. He now has no time to pastor people or to preach or to teach. And Matthew Henry says, the work becomes neglected because the workmen are. The work becomes neglected because the workmen are. Now contrast that with the commitments that they themselves have made in chapter 10, verse 32, where they said things like, we assume the responsibility for carrying out the commands to give a third of a shekel each year for the service of the house our God. They go on later to say, also, as it is also written in the law, we will bring the firstborn of our sons and the cattle and of cattle and of herds and of flocks and to the house of God, to the priests ministering there. Goes on to give many more details. The people of Israel, including the Levites, are to bring their contributions of grain, new wine and olive oil to the storerooms, same place that Tobiah ended up, when the articles for the sanctuary and for ministering priests, gatekeepers and musicians are also kept. We will not neglect the house of our God. Nehemiah goes away, we're not sure for how long, and comes back and finds they have neglected the house of their God. So he springs into action again, and once again he puts the administration of offerings back onto a firm footing so that this restored community can actually operate like it's meant to. It can live out, we might say, its covenant privilege. And again, we see Nehemiah's fearless action as he confronts, as he rebukes the officials, and we see it again later in verse 17. So there's an application here, a direct one to do with giving to God's work. One is to God's people, make sure you're doing it, make sure you are giving to God's work, and make sure it is God's work. Don't just give blindly. Bringing us to our third section, dealing with Sabbath breaking, starting verse 15. In those days I saw people in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in grain and loading it on donkeys together with wine, grapes, figs and all other kinds of loads. Now, what we're not going to do tonight is argue a case for or against the Christian Sunday being an exact equivalent of the old Jewish Sabbath. There are certain senses in which it should be, certain senses in which it clearly shouldn't be. But we won't go into that tonight, but just see what the significance was in that society and that community in doing what they did. Basically, the community once again sins, this time by breaking the Sabbath, which leads Nehemiah to rebuke them again. They're breaking it by trading. Now, the people from Tyre, the Tyrians, are foreigners who would not be bound by Sabbath law. Didn't bother them that they were trading on Sunday. But unfortunately, they found a ready market amongst God's people, among the Jews. They shouldn't have done, but they did. So this Sabbath breaching turns out to be a very telling aspect of previous generations' lax attitude towards the Torah, towards God's law. There's some wonderful stories around, but quite a number of years ago, we were down in St. Ives for a weekend, as I recall, and somehow picked up a story about the pilchard fishing that used to be huge from St. Ives. And they were all God-fearing people, well, nearly all, and no matter what they spotted out at sea, they would not go out fishing on a Sunday. But there was obviously a Sunday when some huge shoal, and apparently you can see them from the cliffs. I don't know what that looks like, but it's obvious to people that know what they're looking for. There's a huge shoal of pilchards observed by somebody. I mean, maybe their fault was looking on a Sunday, and it got too much for them. And the crew got in the boat, and they went out, and they got a whopping catch. All went well until they came back to the quayside, where they were met by several other crews who basically said, put them all back. Now, that's a very quaint story because I can't imagine that happening on any level today, but they didn't benefit from their pilchard fishing, wasted their time. But if we were to read in places like Jeremiah 17, verse 19 and following, Amos 8, verse 4 and following, we can see what a significant thing Sabbath breaking was in the Old Testament in terms of where people stood in relation to God, their trust in him, their obedience to him. And here, we didn't read it all just again, but Colin read it all earlier, that we see that the exile itself is in a sense blamed or attributed to Sabbath breaking. That's why they got into this state in the first place, because their predecessors, their ancestors did such a thing. And there's a lovely saying, isn't there? There's a lot of versions of this, and Liz will probably know most of them. But I think it comes from somebody called George Santayana, who died the year I was born. I'm sure I'm not responsible for it. Who said, those who ignore history are condemned to repeat it. There's a lot of versions of that, but I think that's about the neatest. Those who ignore history are condemned to repeat it. And these people were essentially ignoring their own history. And indeed, they are repeating it. And then from verse 19, this lovely piece of prose here, isn't there? When evening shadows fell on the gates of Jerusalem. I mean, I'd be pleased if I could write like that. Okay, it was evening. We've got it, but it's nicely put. What happened? He orders the doors to be shut. I mean, sometimes there's a really simple solution, isn't there, to sin? Orders the door to be shut and not opened until the Sabbath was over. Stationed some of his own men at the gates so that no load could be brought in on the Sabbath day. And then this next bit, I think, is just worth us dwelling on a moment. Verse 20, once or twice, merchants and sellers of all kinds of goods spent the night outside Jerusalem. Can't you just picture it? The gates have been locked. They've been put outside. That's surely it. Well, they've not gone home. They're just loitering outside. What are they doing that for? They're behaving like the pilchard shoal, aren't they? They're just hovering. They're just, you know, we're here just in case you feel tempted. And now, it's not clear whether Nehemiah is still the governor at this point, but it is clear that he still has enough clout and authority and resources. He's got enough bobbies on the beat to enforce this. And when he threatens them with arrest, I imagine that is exactly what would happen if they didn't disappear. And we can take that from the fact that they promptly did disappear, which is good. But when we think about that, we have this picture, don't we, of sin camped just outside the wall. The proximity of sin, I think, is one of the things we're supposed to pick up here. You know, as Christians, we're not in the business of how near can we get to it without actually sinning. You know, what can we get away with? Always looking for loopholes in the law, that sort of mentality. But it's equally important, I think, that we see that sin is always ready. You know, Satan never rests. He knows our weak points. Our enemy is constant. He's vigilant. He's always nearby. And we'll come back to this later, but there's a phrase in the Bible in both Old and New Testament that's repeated many times and used in many different ways, which is, be on your guard. Be on your guard. Jesus used it, be on your guard against the hypocrisy of the Pharisees. Be on your guard when you're dragged before governors and kings. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. In the book of Acts, be on your guard against savage wolves coming in amongst you. In 1 Corinthians 16, be on your guard, stand firm in the faith, be courageous and strong. And then in 2 Timothy, Paul says, be on your guard against Alexander the metal worker, who did me a great deal of harm. He strongly opposed our message, a Tobiah of his day, we might say. And then in 2 Peter, Peter says, be on your guard so that you may not be carried away by the error of the lawlessness. And we need, in all sorts of ways in our lives, don't we, as Christian leaders and as Christians, to be on our guard. Now, does all this sound too hard? Well, yes, of course it is. It's way too hard for us to live in this way without Christ. But if you're a Christian tonight, you're not without Christ. And therefore, the means to be on your guard and the means to stand against these things is actually available to you. Which brings us to our next section, the problem of marriage. We'll come to it again. And moreover, in those days I saw men of Judah who had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. And then we enter this problem of the spoken language. Well, commitments like Sabbath keeping had been ignored, and this leads somehow to a loss of identity in Israel, and it leads to intermarriage with persons of other religions. Now, Ezra's measures, we haven't looked at the book of Ezra, but it's there to be read, and in chapters 9 and 10 of that book, the measures he takes against this marrying people from other religions, that kind of mixed marriage is illustrated vividly here. The problem Nehemiah is acutely aware of. We've got children of these unions losing the language of Judah. Now, we might not think that was a big deal, but in effect, what it meant was they were losing their entire religious heritage. And Nehemiah's reaction, we might not probably approve of that, actually, but it's symbolically powerful, isn't it, as he beats people and pulls their hair. He says some of the men, he pulled their hair. Perhaps the rest were bald already. I don't know. But if we were to turn to Deuteronomy 7, 1 to 5, when the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, the Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, seven nations larger and stronger than you, and when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and you've defeated them, you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them and show them no mercy. Do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons and take their daughters for your sons, for they will turn your children away from following me to serve other gods. And the Lord's anger will burn against you and will quickly destroy you. This is what you are to do with them. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, cut down their Asherah poles, and burn their idols in the fire. And we've seen in the passage that Colin read earlier, around about verse 26, that Nehemiah gives the example of Solomon. Even Solomon, he says, had been turned from his faithfulness to God, which was an impressive faithfulness to the Lord, by his foreign wives. This is not just theory, is it? This really happened, and in a spiritual sense, still really happens. And then we read verse 28, one of the sons of Joada, a son of Eliashib, high priest, was son-in-law to Sanballat the Horonite, and I drove him away from me. And Sanballat is another name that should bring us a feeling of foreboding. If this was a film, it would be a kind of right kind of music again, because this he's just bad news. And it turns out he's related by marriage to the high priest. So again, Eliashib, the high priest, doesn't exactly cover himself with glory, does he? This is a kind of spiritual adulteration that's affected even his family. Compare that with the promise in chapter 10, verse 30, we promise not to give our daughters in marriage to the peoples around us or take their daughters for our sons. Right. So verse 29, remember them, my God, because they defiled the priestly office and the covenant of the priesthood and of the Levites. Remember them. We've heard this before. It's a little phrase that we come across in several times in this chapter. Remember them, my God. Back in chapter 6, verse 14, remember Tobiah and Sanballat, my God, because of what they've done and how they have been trying to intimidate me. Now, the reference there to the covenant of the priesthood in verse 29 is really a reference to the special obligations laid on priests and Levites for the sake of the whole people. You might remember the story back in 1 Samuel 2, where there's a curse on the priest Eli and his descendants, for, we read in verse 27 of 1 Samuel 2, scorning my sacrifice and offerings that I prescribe for my dwelling. Why do you honor your sons more than me by fattening yourselves on the choice parts of every offering made by my people Israel? And not many months ago, our Friday home group were looking at the book of Malachi, and we came across Malachi 2, verse 4 onwards. I have sent you, says God, this warning so that my covenant with Levi may continue. My covenant was with him, a covenant of life and peace, and I gave them to him. This called for reverence, and he revered me and stood in awe of my name. True instruction was in his mouth, and nothing false was found on his lips. He walked with me in peace and uprightness and turned many from sin. And then here in verse 7 of Malachi 2, for the lips of a priest ought to preserve knowledge, because he is the messenger of the Lord Almighty, and people seek instruction from his mouth. But you have turned from my way, and by your teaching have caused many to stumble. You violated the covenant with Levi, says the Lord Almighty. So I have caused you to be despised and humiliated before all the people, because you've not followed my ways, but have shown partiality in matters of the law. So Eliashib, the high priest, by his example, and we can probably take it by his teaching also, was causing men to stumble, the exact opposite of what God intended him to do. So we need two practical application there. When we're looking for church leaders, when we're appointing leaders, we need to take great care, lest by their example and their teaching, they cause many to stumble. We're nearly at the end of the passage, but we've come to the little summary at the end of Nehemiah's temple reform. So I purified priests and Levites of everything foreign and assigned them duties, each to his own task. I made provision for contributions of wood at designated times and for first fruits. Remember me with favor, my God. So these verses, in a way, highlight all that Nehemiah has done in possibly the whole book. To, first of all, ensure pure worship in the temple, and secondly, to establish proper support for the priests. This wood offering is a reference to chapter 10, verse 34. Another promise they hadn't been keeping that Nehemiah restored. And so remember me. Similar to verse 14. It's a prayer that stands alone. It could be taken as a general prayer that God should keep in view all of Nehemiah's work from start to finish. Does this sound a bit like salvation by works? Or is it more recognizing that his reward is not going to be from man and it's not going to be in this life? But God will remember what he's done. He can just rest assured in that. It might be interesting just to think of Matthew 25, 21, where the master replied, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I'll put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness in the next world." So a few closing comments. I think I need to say this. There is no, what we've been saying about foreigners has, I have to say this because she's not in the room right at the moment, but my Australian daughter-in-law is in the room, so I have to say this, but I was going to anyway, that that there's no bearing whatsoever on current immigration issues when we're talking about foreigners here. These foreigners were heathen people worshipping idols and false gods who were not allowed to infiltrate and lead astray God's special people, Israel. There's no sense at all here of people shouldn't cross borders. There's no sense at all that these heathen nations couldn't intermarry amongst themselves. That was fine, or at least it was no worse than they were already doing. But of course, that's not saying that there's no issue to sort out, and we need to pray for our government in this really knotty problem that they are facing and will increasingly face over the, we hear it every night on the news, don't we, over the next few years. It's just that you can't use these verses in any way to justify a particular position on, let's say, the current European issue. And referring again to gardening being never finished, what we're really talking about here then is the work of sanctification. In other words, that work of being set apart for God's special use as his special people. That work never finishes this side of glory. Not sure what happens to the other side of glory, but it certainly doesn't finish this side. And that is true equally of you and your church. So the moment you think, in any sense at all, that you've arrived, you're sitting in the garden on the pleasure lawns admiring the flower borders, it's at that same moment that you're falling, you are already actually falling into conceit and into sin, because it doesn't work like that. So in terms of general applications from what we've been looking at, we've seen don't give the enemy a room in your temple or give him camping space outside your gates. Sin is crouching at the door. Now, I don't know whether you remember where that's first said. Right back in Genesis 4. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what's right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it." Now, sin is crouching at the door in a general sense if you're a Christian. And that's why, if we can move on, that's why, there we are, be on your guard is such an important motto for our lives, if you like. A strong biblical theme. Whilst the words aren't actually used in this passage, the sentiment certainly is. And is that true of all of us? Yes, it is. It's true for church leaders who have to be especially on their guard over doctrine, over keeping a pure gospel. It's true for every church member, basically on the same basis, and for every Christian, in fact. Now, Nehemiah, the book, should enable us to have a thoroughly biblical, in other words, God's perspective on the Christian life. So we have, as we look at Nehemiah, the most real and practical and truthful view of life in this sinful world. Now, in as much as Nehemiah is a type of Christ, a sort of picture of him in the Old Testament, we can see that he was the agent that God used to both repair Jerusalem and to recommit the exiles to their promises, to their covenant with Yahweh, with the Lord. But he's also the agent of continued reform. The title for the sermon is Unfinished Work, Continued Reform, Renewal and Repair of these same people. They'd not arrived in any sense. And I was saying to Colin before the service that told my home group about this years ago, they've probably forgotten. But Tim Keller, the American pastor and writer, there's a little YouTube clip, and I strongly recommend it to you. You probably need to watch it about three times to get it all. But if you typed in something like Tim Keller True and Better, you would get it, because the whole theme is all the typology in the whole of the Old Testament and how Jesus is the true and better, you name it. He's the true and better Moses. He's the true and better rock that Moses struck, and so it goes on. Now, I don't think he actually puts Nehemiah in this one, but I think it's reasonably obvious that there is some typology going on here. And remember, it was when Nehemiah was away that things went awry. And for us, times, in any sense, spent away from Christ will have the same effect on our lives. You know, our salvation, the day we were saved, was a very fundamental repair, wasn't it, in our lives, you might say, occurring at that point. But we also have to, as the New Testament makes clear, continue to work out our salvation with fear and trembling, Philippians 2, verse 12. And that's for all of our lives here on earth, isn't it? Unfortunately, the enemy within and the enemy without, won't go away. So may God grant us help and in Christ's strength as we search the temple of our lives, of our hearts, and throw out our Tobias and our Sanballats and learn not to be content to have sin camped just outside our gates. Let's learn what to get rid of and what to walk away from rather than fall into sin. This was something that the psalmist David understood, and we're going to have our closing hymn now if you want to get into place, musicians, but in Psalm 139, which you're going to sort of sing from in a moment. "Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting."